This is episode 31 of the Investors Podcast.
Broadcasting from Bel Air, Maryland, this is the Investors Podcast. They'll read the books and summarize the lessons. They'll test the waters and tell you when it's cold. They'll give you actionable investing strategies. Your host, Preston Pish and Stig Broderson.
Hey, 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 how's everybody doing today? This is Preston Pish, and I'm your host for The Investors Podcast. And as usual, I am accompanied by my co-host, Stig Broderson, out in Denmark. And I'll tell you what, folks, we have got the coolest interview for you today because our guest is a person who went and interviewed 30 different people. And let me just give you some names of some of these people that she's interviewed. She has interviewed Warren Buffett. She has interviewed Kathy Ireland. She has interviewed Anderson Cooper. She's interviewed Jim Koch, who founded Samuel Adams. She's interviewed Michael Bloomberg. And I could keep going on and on and on. I mean, what kind of access you're going to get today to hear about these interviews from these people? It's just phenomenal. And so what she did is she interviewed 30 different people that are just enormous successes in all these different fields. And then she wrote a book, and the name of the book is Getting There. It just came out this past week. And she summarized all these interviews, and each interview is about 6 pages in the book. And so her name is Jillian Zoe Siegel, and she's here today to talk about all these different interviews that she had with these people. So without further delay, we're going to go ahead and Jillian, did you have anything that you wanted to add or highlight about the book that maybe I missed?
No, you did a great job.
All right. Perfect. So this is just, I can't stress it enough, folks, the information you're going to get out of this is just fantastic because she just got the behind the scenes access. And really the point of the book, this is the thing that I really want to highlight, is that she talks about the idea that the path to success isn't necessarily what a lot of people think that it is. People would think that a person like Michael Bloomberg just, you know, he came from maybe a wealthy background and all these people just naturally had this stuff handed over to them. But what she debunks in this book is she talks about that struggle and those stories for each of these people and how they broke through and the things that they did to go from just being a nobody to being, you know, a billionaire or whatever the case might be for each one of them. And so that was what was really amazing about the book is she talks about those points, those things that they had to do in order to break through. So without further delay, we're going to go ahead and kick this off. And I'm going to take the first question, Stig. So the first one that we got here is we're going to start off with the discussing Warren Buffett. So in your book, one of your main points that Warren Buffett made during your interview, was it really fun interviewing him, by the way? Was it?
It was incredible to interview him. I mean, he's amazing when you can view him from a distance, but there's something really powerful about, you know, being in his presence and being in his really down to earth office. You wouldn't believe how down to earth it is.
Let's talk about that. Yeah, let's talk about it. So, you know, what's really cool, and I didn't say this in the introduction, was Jillian took all the pictures of each of the people that she interviewed. So she actually has a picture of Warren Buffett sitting on his desk in the book.
Yes.
So one of the things that I noticed in that picture, the first and foremost, he has like this tray that's right there on his desk, and it says the too hard bin, or it says too hard. And I just found that hilarious. Was there anything else that you saw when you were in his office that was just really kind of unique?
Something really unique these days, and you might not be able to notice because he's sitting on his desk, but behind him, there is no computer. That is
come on.
There's no computer. He doesn't do that.
So, well, I mean, is he just reading the Wall Street Journal? I mean, did you guys talk about that at all? Or was it just something that you kind of noticed and were kind of floored by?
You know, it was something that I noticed. It was something that I had heard. And so I didn't bring it up. And you know what? It was about 5 years ago, because it took me 5 years to do this book anyway. But it was about 5 years ago that I was in his office last. And so I don't know if he uses one. I think he uses a computer to play bridge, but that's it.
Well, we know he's a big bridge fan. I didn't know that he didn't even have a computer there on his desk, though.
Yeah.
Now, does he have a TV in there? Is he watching TV?
You know, I don't remember. I bet there might be. You know what? I don't remember if there was a TV or not. It's like, it's a, you know, a big corner office, but it's not fancy in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Compared to some of the other people you interviewed, I'm sure.
Compared to Leslie Moonves' office.
Yeah, but Jill, it's just one floor, isn't it? Like the headquarters of Berkshire Hathaway. Is that true?
Actually, I think I was only on one floor, but I think there is another floor where there's conferences, but, you know, conference rooms and stuff, because I remember them talking about something about, you know, photographers setting up or something. But I was scheduled for 10 to 15 minutes with him. So as soon as I walked in there, I had my camera, you know, at my eye because I didn't want to waste any time. And, you know, really that is way too little time for the kind of interview I wanted to do. And luckily we ended up spending about an hour together. And so I got all the information in the book.
Wow. So he gave you a full hour. That's amazing.
Yeah. He is a great guy. And, you know, I got to ask him everything I wanted to ask him, except about the computer.
That's really funny. You know, it's funny in his shareholder letters, at the end of his shareholder letters, he always, in a passive aggressive way, brags about how small his headquarters is. What is it? It's like 30 or 40 people, Stig? I can't remember.
Yeah, it seems about right. It's not more. You wouldn't believe that it's one of the biggest companies in the U.S., right? When you're looking from it, from the outside, at least. I don't know about the inside.
Absolutely not. I actually just recently went to Bloomberg's headquarters.
Yeah.
That is like, you know, out of a science fiction movie. Like, you're surprised anyone's walking. You'd expect they should all be on Segways or something.
No, that's a great point, because you look at Berkshire. I'm pretty sure their market cap's over $300 billion. So when you think of that, their market cap's over $300 billion company, and they've got like 30 or 40 people working in the headquarters, and that's it. I mean, that's just mind blowing. It's just insane.
It is. I think you know, he keeps it simple, and I think, and he speaks about this in the essay. He is a big delegator, but he really pays close attention to the people he delegates to, and he's a great judge of character, if I don't say so myself.
I like that. You're so smooth. Yeah. You know, that gets to the question I was actually going to ask, was what you're hitting on here. So let me just read this question here. I have it written down. I say, in your book, one of your main points that Warren Buffett made during the interview was that most people go through life using up a very small part of their potential. He said that the people that functioned best were the ones that were efficient, opposed to the ones with the biggest engines. So based on your interview, how do you think that became so efficient? How do you think he finds these people that are so efficient? What is he really looking for that describes that?
Well, I think that he has he just, you know, has great intuition, and he finds people who he trusts, I think. And he is such a remarkable person that I think he makes everyone want to make him proud. Like, everybody cares what he thinks, because you can't not.
Yeah.
So I think that it works both ways, that people feel good probably that he trusts them and gives them responsibility, and they don't want to let him down.
Yeah.
And he says something in my interview with him. He says it's important to realize that other people are going to make mistakes, and he's made mistakes. And with his managers, he just has to decide whether they know what they're doing overall or not.
You know, I really like that point, because I see so many leaders have this zero defect environment that they try to, that no one can make a mistake. And if you make a mistake, you're done. I mean, you really see that a lot in large organizations, robust organizations, that there's this zero defect environment. And I think that you're actually setting a standard for people to lie to you, for people to tell you whatever in the world it is that you want to hear, opposed to what the truth actually is. And so when you see somebody like Buffett sitting up there at the very top of such a large organization, and he's saying, you're going to make mistakes, and when you do, come and tell me, we'll work through it, we'll figure it out. I mean, that's really what you're getting at. And it's amazing that More people don't adopt that. It's just crazy to me, but.
Yeah, he says in the interview, he said, "I'm not big on blame, and by other people's standards, I'm probably quite tolerant of our manager's mistakes." Like, he doesn't want to blame people because he knows he makes mistakes too.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't think he has other options. Like, he wants to run a really small operation, and I think it's almost impossible if he has to micromanage. I can't remember how many thousands of tens of thousands of people he's employing. So if he wants to have this very, very small operations, I mean, he needs to trust people, right? So it's kind of out of necessity, but I also think it's the way that he looks at business, to be honest.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, his direct companies that he owns, operationally owns, I want to say is close to 70 businesses. I mean, that's just crazy when you think about it. And then you're not even talking about the non-operational subsidiaries like Coke and, you know, IBM and some of those other ones that he's, you know, he's actively involved in, but he's not, managing because it's just a passive role.
But, mm-hmm.
As you can hear, Jillian, we really geeks about Warren Buffett, you know.
Yeah, we know all the nitinoid facts.
I'm with you. Yeah.
That's good because, you know, originally we was actually going to interview you about Warren Buffett, and now we're just jabbing.
Yeah, we're talking about what we know. Yeah, it's
a bad other.
We're doing a bad job here.
I like hearing this.
Okay, let's take the next question. So I once read a story about Warren Buffett, and it was emphasizing the importance of learning to ask the right questions. So he tells a story about a person standing next to a dog and a stranger. The stranger asks the person, "Does your dog bite?" The person said, "No." So the stranger reached down and petted the dog, and the dog bit him. Alarmed, the stranger said, "I thought you said the dog doesn't bite." So the man said, "Well, that's not my dog." So, Jillian, you interviewed 30 of the most successful people, you know, in the world, and very few of us could only dream to have access to these people. So how did you come up with the questions that you had to ask them? What's the process for preparing for the interview?
Here's what I did. You know, I looked everybody up and I prepared as well as I could. But really, I think when you're, if all I would ask them about was the stuff that was already out there, what good would that do? So I looked them up to know as much as I could, but then I made sure to ask open-ended questions so I could learn new material. And I think that's something people have to do in life. You know, you've got to not always talk about yourself and just listen to others. 'Cause you get some great things when you do that.
Absolutely. Okay. So I got a question off the cuff here. So, one of the people that you interviewed was, Sarah Blakely, who's the billionaire that founded Spanx. And I recently saw that you wrote an article, how you landed your interview with Warren Buffett based on some of the advice that Sarah gave you. So can you talk to our audience a little bit about that?
All right. Well, first of all, Sarah Blakely is incredible. She wanted to be a lawyer her whole life. And, you know, her whole life was geared toward that. Her father was a trial lawyer, and that's just what she wanted to do. She knew she was going to do that. Then she bombed the law school admissions test twice. She, you know, the first time she studied, picked herself off the floor, took it again. She did 1 point worse than she did the first time. So she was not feeling too great. She ended up getting a ride. Getting a job loading rides at Disney's Epcot Center.
Wow.
And then she spent 8 years working for a company that sold fax machines door to door. And it was during that period that she had her, you know, aha moment. And she was trying on a pair of white pants, and she thought that it would look better if she had some kind of controlled top pantyhose underneath. The only problem was they didn't make those without the feet. So she just wanted the top. So she invented something called Spanx, which is basically footless controlled top pantyhose. It's evolved into a lot of different things since then. It's a shapewear company, but it's every single lady knows what this is, and every single man has been out with a lady wearing Spanx, unbeknownst to him.
Every man has benefited from them.
Yes. Anyway, so Sarah is such a gutsy person. Like, you know, she started her company with her, you know, with her guts, basically. Yeah. And she it was hard for her to even get a prototype of Spanx made. She would kind of camp out at the mill owners in their waiting areas because nobody would even take her call. And then when she finally got her prototype made, she convinced the buyer at Neiman Marcus to order her product by taking the buyer into the bathroom and showing them what her butt looked like with and without Spanx. So in her white pants.
But she went on. I mean, it was totally off the cuff. From reading this in the book, it was amazing because you talk about how hard it was to get into one of these interviews. But then she just had this opportunity where she had a buyer and she just takes them into the bathroom, and it was just like so off the cuff. And she pulled off the move of all moves. It was just like life changing, you know.
Yes. So I was really, you know, impressed with her and inspired by her. And I was at an event that Warren Buffett was at, and I wanted to approach him to be in getting there, to be in my book. And I'd already been rejected by his office once. So it was a little bit, you know, uncomfortable to go up to him. And it wasn't even like we were supposed to go up to him and all of that. So, of course, I was nervous, but I thought to myself, Sarah Blakely would do it. She would not let this opportunity pass. And I just knew if I didn't do it, I wouldn't want to face her again. And I also would feel so bad about myself. So, you know, the least I had to do was ask. So I went up and I asked him really quickly. And basically, he just said, you know, get in touch with my office. So I had to send all of the information in, you know, what the book was and everything. And I got in that way. So
this is a story of persistence. You know, if there's one thing to take away from the first story with Sarah Blakely and then the story with Jillian getting the interview with Warren, is it's all about being persistent. You heard her say, I already asked and I was denied. Well, so 99% of the people out there would say, well, he's inaccessible. I cannot get an interview with Warren Buffett because I tried, I asked, and they said no. But you know what? You just kept at it. And I think that that's the biggest key. And I think, you know, when you go through all the interviews in your book, that's one of the main themes that I saw was these people are persistent. They do not take no for an answer. They just keep at it. And it's, you know, it's a fantastic point, and it's really representative of yourself as well, Jillian.
Thank you. You know what? If I had to say one, you know, theme or one characteristic that everybody in the book has, it's the resilience. Like, they get knocked down, they get back up. They get knocked down again, they get back up. And if you keep doing that enough times, one of your things is going to pay off. You know, one of your ideas, one of your efforts, whatever it is, you just have to be resilient, and you have to know that, you know, failure is just part of the process. And Kathy Ireland has a quote, which I just love. She says, you know, if you're not failing, you're not trying hard enough. And it's just good to remember that when you fail.
No, absolutely. You know,
just to think, okay, I'm doing my job. I'm doing what I should.
Yeah.
But what about you, Jillian? Like, were you so determined that you want to have Warren Buffett in the book that you was just keep on trying until you got him on the book? Or what was your strategy for that, actually? How long can you do this?
You know, here's the thing. You have to make a balance between being persistent, but you also have to be polite, and you also have to have, you know, a monitor. So if you get a real no from somebody, from the real decision maker, you know,
yeah, then, it's not one of the gatekeepers.
Exactly. Then you might take it as a no. You might wait a while, then try again. But you don't want to be an annoying person. And that's, you know, that's something you've got to look out for. But somebody told me very early on in the process, a friend of mine named Steve Cohen, he said, we went to college together. He said, don't take a no from someone who can't give you a yes. And what that
means, I love that.
Isn't that
good? That is good.
Yes. So, like, if you get a no from somebody's publicist or someone's assistant or whatever, don't really take that so seriously, because you don't know whether the real decision maker ever even saw your request. Like we were discussing with Warren Buffett, these people are very busy and they have to delegate. So some people screen requests for them. Mm-hmm. And it's not a scientific process. They might screen out a request that the decision maker would have said yes to. So I always say, you know, like, if you can't get in the front door, try the back door. If that's locked, try the side door. And if that's locked, try climbing in a window. If you can't do that, then try the front door again, because someone might answer this time.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
The dream of owning a vacation home can be daunting. From finding the best guests, to the maintenance, to organizing the cleaners after every guest stay. With Vacasa, they make that dream into a reality. As a full-service vacation home management company with vacation homes in key destinations across the U.S., they know how to make owning a vacation home easy and profitable. On top of proactive property maintenance visits by professional local teams, a data-driven booking platform, and around-the-clock support, homeowners earn on average 20% or more revenue from their vacation homes. Vacasa makes vacation home ownership easy. If you're looking to make more from your vacation home by doing less, partner with Vacasa at vacasa.com. That's vacasa.com to get started on your dream of owning a vacation home. Have you ever wondered if there's an AI tool like ChatGPT specifically built for the stock market? A tool that not only aids you in your research and analysis process, but also allows for dynamic discussions? Today, I want to share such a tool with you called Meka. Meka is the AI-powered stock research assistant now enhanced with real-time stock data. Meka does a lot of the heavy lifting of sifting through financial statements and company data and delivers it to you nearly instantaneously, and the best part is that it's 100% free. Try it out today and ask Meka questions like, what is the financial health of Microsoft? How much cash does Copart hold on its balance sheet? What is the return on invested capital of Adobe, or millions of other prompts? Check it out today for free at Meyka.com. That's Meyka.com. Today's episode is sponsored by Range Rover Sport. Range Rover Sport leads by example with their dynamic design that rises to the occasion. It's got powerful on-road performance and commanding all-terrain capabilities, coupled with signature Range Rover refinement. The third generation Range Rover Sport is the most desirable, advanced, and dynamically capable one yet, redefining sporting luxury. It's got advanced cabin technologies such as active noise cancellation and cabin air purification, offering next level comfort and refinement. The purposeful cockpit light driving position sets the tone for a focused interior that promotes exhilarating driver engagement. Award-winning Pivi Pro infotainment is at the heart of the experience and provides intuitive control of the vehicle systems. You can enjoy a dynamic drive and total comfort with optional 22-way adjustable, heated, and ventilated electric memory front seats with massage function. Design your Range Rover Sport at LandRoverUSA.com. That's LandRoverUSA.com.
All right, back to the show.
But the key is there's a lot of ways to get in. And I think that that's what you're really getting at with your analogy is people just try the front door. And typically that's the hardest one to get in. So, stay persistent and get creative with your the way that you're going to approach it. I mean, that's
if
awesome.
If somebody's publicist says no, try calling their office. Try calling a business that they run. You just have to try getting in anyway. And then really, in the end, you could only lead a horse to water. So you just have to make sure that the horse saw the water. And what I mean by that is you have to make sure that the decision maker really saw your request. And so with a lot of these subjects, I was, you know, rejected so many times. When I finally got in, the person never knew I had even asked before.
Yeah. Yeah.
They didn't know. That happened with Frank Gehry. I was the architect, Frank Gehry. I was rejected four times, two times on my own, two times via, you know, someone who knew him. And then one day I just decided emails are free. I'll send another one. just to the, you know, the address listed on his website, and somehow I got in that way.
So, and here's the real message for the audience, because I don't think everybody out there is going to be trying to write a book with, you know, all these different celebrities in it. The key point for you who's listening to this is, if say there's a job you want to go get, or let's say that there's something that you're really desiring and there's these gatekeepers or there's something in your way.
If you're looking for investors your business or anything. Yeah.
Whatever it is, you need to listen to this tale and this story of her persistence to go out and just find these interviews with people that most people, to even get one interview with these people would be, you know, somebody might try 1 to 5 times and they wouldn't get it. And then they'd just be, the whole book would be done. You know, you've got to stay persistent and you've got to stay consistent. You got to do the same thing. You got to be very systematic in the way you do things. And if you do that time and time again, it's amazing what will come your way, and how it'll lead you to that goal that you have. So just an incredible story. I think more towards you, Jillian, than anything else.
Well, the good thing is, the good thing is, I was doing a book on this very subject. So just every person I met kind of kept me going in the process of making the book. Every person I met, you know, John Paul DeGioia, who's the founder of John Paul Mitchell Hair Systems and the Patron Spirits Company, the tequila company. He has an incredible story anyway, which we could talk about or not, but every one of these people kept me going.
Yeah.
So Jillian, one of the main goals for writing this book was to figure out whether success was a prerequisite for some people or whether it was an acquired personal skill set like tenacity and strength infused from experiences. So what is your conclusion based on these interviews?
Well, my conclusion is that I think you are born with a certain disposition, and you're probably born with certain natural strengths and weaknesses. But if I thought that was that and your fate was sealed at birth, I wouldn't write an inspirational book like this. I think that I think you're born with a kind of skill set, and then you have to know how to reach your potential from what you're born with. And I think there's a tremendous amount that you can do, you know, that you can learn. So it's like a nature versus nurture question. And I believe in both. And so, you know, Warren Buffett talks about your circle of competence. And he says that you've got to do something that you're passionate about. You have to pursue something you're passionate about, but you also have to pursue something that is within your circle of competence. And what he means is that no one is good at everything, and you've got to know your strengths and weaknesses and pursue something you're skilled at. He says the most important thing in terms of your circle isn't how large it is, but it's how well you define the perimeter. And if you know where your edges are, you're way better off than someone who has a circle 5 times as large, but is very fuzzy about the borders. He actually quotes his friend, Tom Watson, who's the founder of IBM, who said, I'm no genius, but I'm smart in spots and I stay around those spots.
George Soros is real big on saying that as well, where he says that he's very good at knowing whenever he's wrong. And he attributes most of his success to the fact that he can attribute that. But that's just a side note.
And, you know, in my book is a good example of this, because everyone in my book was selected because they're at the top of their field. But you couldn't interchange them all, you know. So someone, different artists and different, you know, different people, not everyone would do so well if they were in the other person's business. They're all pursuing something that they're passionate about and good at, and that is why they're successful.
So Michael Bloomberg attributes his success to a lot of his success, not all of it, but a lot of his success to being an early riser. So he has a really funny story in your book where he's talking about coffee and tea. And can you tell that story to our audience? Because I think they'll really eat it up.
Yes. Okay. Well, one thing that a lot of people don't know was that early in his career, Michael Bloomberg was fired He worked for Salomon Brothers, and he loved it, loved it, loved it. But after 15 years there, they sold the company, they restructured, and he got the boot. And no one came running to give him another job. And so that is why he started his own company. And so that's a great story in and of itself. But while he was starting his company, he wanted some feedback. So he used to go to the coffee store across from Merrill Lynch's headquarters at 6 a.m. and he'd get a coffee with and without milk, and he'd get a tea with and without milk, and he'd put them in a tray, and then he would go roaming the halls of Merrill Lynch looking for an executive who was sitting alone reading the paper. He'd pop his head in the door and he would say, "Hi, I bought you some coffee. Can I bend your ear?" Because he wanted feedback on his business. And he says, no one's going to kick you out if you brought them a coffee. And then he said, if the person said, "I don't drink coffee," he'd say, "Well, then I have tea." So what I love also about this story, you know, he's also got that chutzpah, the guts, you know, that Sarah Blakely has. It also shows that when you're starting your own business, don't think you're above anything. You know, walk around delivering coffee and tea if you need to get what you want or to help your business.
And so the reason he had the four different kinds of tea and coffee is because, and you talk about this in the book, whenever he'd go in and he'd say, "Hey, you want a coffee?" And the person say, "No, I don't drink coffee." And he goes, "Well, I've got a tea. You want a tea?" And he just he had every option available. He had it completely mapped out. Yep. So that there was no way they could back out of the request.
With, without milk, everything. He had them all. He had sugars on the side. He was like a mobile coffee shop.
Mm-hmm. Hey, and just so our audience knows, so Jillian lives in Manhattan. So you heard a little bit of the noise there in the background. But Stig, do you got the next question?
So, Jillian, this question, that's also about Warren Buffett, at least partly. So, despite all his wealth, it's clear from the interview with Warren Buffett that he's extremely humble, and he's rather saying that America has been fortunate to reward him his unique skill set than saying he deserves his wealth from working harder and being better than other people. You also find that Michael Bloomberg gets his drive from people saying what he can and can't do. So all of these questions must have made a great impact on you. Who has made the biggest impression on you and why?
Stig, that's a great question, but a tough one, because it's sort of like asking me to pick my favorite child. And I love everyone who's in the book. I pick them all because they're so inspirational and I admire them. But I think it is hard to have Warren Buffett in a book and not really fall for him. But since we've talked about him a lot, I'm going to talk about someone else, and that's J. Craig Venter. He is a scientist, and he was the first to sequence the human genome. And what that means, because I didn't really know exactly what that meant before I researched him, reading a genome is basically reading a human's DNA to see what it has to say. And the medical possibilities that this information can lead to are endless. So basically, if you know what genes a certain person has and you understand what that means, you'll know how likely someone is to develop a certain disease. And if they do develop that disease, what you should do, what kind of treatments will respond best to that. And he has just an incredible story. Now, well, number one, every single person listening here benefits from this information. You know, every time you go to the doctor, it's brought a whole new level to the medical profession with what they can see and how they can help us.
Are they designing just different medicines around the fact that they understand how the DNA is constructed? Is that what you mean by that?
They're doing everything. Like everything's basically is stemming from this now.
Wow.
It was a big breakthrough, a huge breakthrough for diagnosing You know, it used to be that a doctor would look at you and take your blood or whatever. Now they can look at your DNA. It's just another step, not just your blood. Anyway, so you would think that this genius scientist would have been a good student growing up, but his name is J. Craig Venter, but he goes by Craig. So he slid by high school on a D minus. Literally, he would have failed.
How is that part? I don't even know how that's. that's just crazy to me how somebody could. Keep going. I don't want to interrupt you. I'm floored by that.
Yeah, he. The only reason he graduated is that they made him write an extra paper so they didn't have to see his face again, because he used to spend his time sitting in the back throwing spitballs at the teachers. And he said one of his friends was an actual member of Hell's Angels. He'd been left back so many times. He was way older than Craig, but that's who he hung out with. And then when he graduated, he had no intention of going to college. He moved to Southern California to be a surfer. And his job was putting price tags on toys at Sears at night.
Unbelievable.
Right? Then the war in Vietnam got in the way of this, and he got drafted. Before he knew it, he was shipped off to Vietnam. He was in the medical corpsman school. And what he saw there was really overwhelming. He saw hundreds to thousands of people his own age,
coming back with limbs and everything imaginable from war. Yeah,
everything imaginable. And he didn't really believe in what America was doing there, so it was really tough for him. He tried to actually commit suicide. He describes this all in the book. And in the middle of his attempt, he realized that he wanted to live. He actually saw a shark. He was trying to drown himself, and he saw a shark. Anyway, you'll have to read it in his own words in getting there. But this changed him, and he decided that he wanted to live, and then he decided that he wanted to help people. He was going to become a doctor, but then he decided mid-process that if he was a scientist, he could help more people. The story goes on and on, you know, just read it. I'd say everyone has to read that story, you know, and how he got to where he was. The path is so crooked.
How old was he at this point? Because for me, I most people, if they don't start going down that path by, you know, like 25, 30, it's very the amount of friction involved in achieving what he's achieved is very difficult. But he sounds like he was kind of at that age. He was maybe in his late 20s when this happened.
You know, he'd been in Vietnam, and then after the war, he went back and he started in a community college. He said he had to learn how to learn for the very first time, because he pretty much, as you could tell by the D minus, ignored school.
Yeah.
You know, he ignored school, but he was a super brilliant person. He just wasn't into school. He actually jokes that he came out of the education system with his curiosity and imagination intact because he avoided the education system.
Oh, that's amazing. That's a really cool story there, Jillian. Fascinating.
To read it. The thing is, I could talk about any one of these people for, you know, 2 hours. So I just don't want to spend the whole rest of this podcast.
No, let's transition into a different person that really, there was something that this lady said in your interview that just blew my mind, and I really liked it. And her expertise was, she was a very famous artist. Her name is Marina Abramović. And she had this quote where she had this professor in college whenever she was learning how to be an artist. And she said, in postgraduate school, I had a special professor who told me something I will never forget. He said, if you draw with your right hand and become so skilled that you can even close your eyes and make any kind of a drawing, immediately change to your left hand. And then she said, repetition will kill you. Can you explain this conversation to our audience and maybe add some more context to this? Because I found this I loved this quote. This is probably one of my favorite quotes in the whole book.
Here's the thing. You know, our world is always evolving and changing. And that's what's necessary for growth. And if you just kept doing the same thing over and over again, where would we be? We'd be back in the Stone Ages. So people have to keep doing new things. And the main thing that stops people from trying new things is the fear of failure. If an artist gets, recognition for a certain kind of art, but just does that and does that and does that and to death, that's what she's saying, it'll kill you. We need to evolve, and you need to not be afraid of failing to do that. And she says that sometimes she's tried things that have been terrible, that have flopped, that she's thought have been terrible. But that's just part of the process.
It's a function of comfort. So a lot of people do something and they get good at it. Like it says, you're there with your right hand and you're so good at it, you can close your eyes, and they get comfortable. And unfortunately for a lot of people, they lose sight of all the other things that are out there that they could potentially do and be successful at because they never try it, because they never step out of that comfort zone. Something else that I really took away from that quote, Jillian, was, and recently in my life, I've come to realize that the more vantage points that I can see something from, the more truth illuminates. And I think that with her quote there, she's talking about if you only see something from the right hand and you only do it the one way your whole life, your ability to see all the other people's vantage points on maybe that particular issue are completely blinded. It's like the curtains are closed. But whenever you have the ability to step out of your own maybe preconceived notions of what you think the truth is, and you really try to understand maybe your opponent's point of view, who has a completely different opinion, and you really try to immerse yourself in their vantage point, it's amazing how much truth and light just illuminates from that.
Mm-hmm. So one of the big themes in my book is that you've got to question everything, but you have to expect resistance to new ideas and approaches. And there are so many examples of this in my book. Mm-hmm. The architect Frank Gehry is in my book, and he says he was always questioning everything. And early in his career, people were not reacting well to this because people get threatened by something new and different. People are comfortable doing things the same way. And if you do something different, it's almost like it's a threat to other people's comfort. There are other people's way of doing things, and it takes a while to sort of get used to it. So Frank, he was called in by his architecture professor the second year of architecture school, and the guy said to him, "Listen, I think you should get out of this field now. You are never going to make it." Can you imagine? And then
it seems like they all have a story like that. They all seem like they've had that person in their life that says, "You're going to be horrible at this. You need to stop doing it."
When Frank Gehry started his own practice, he was on the verge of bankruptcy for a long time. And all of his colleagues, they were all very dismissive of him, and they made fun of his work because it wasn't what they learned in school. It wasn't what architects should be doing. You know, a lot of people care about what you should be, or that's not the way we do things. Or another example is Muhammad Yunus. He grew up in Bangladesh, and the country was in a really terrible state back then. There were people dying in the streets. There was a famine, and he decided that he could help a lot of these people by lending them a tiny, tiny amount of money. It could change their lives. So he wanted to start a bank that would lend tiny amounts of money to really poor people. No one was in on this with him. They all said, "Say goodbye to your money. This will fail. This will fail." Well, he started this bank anyway. It's called the Grameen Bank, and he won a Nobel Peace Prize for it, and it was a success.
Wow.
He says that if you observe something that bothers you, you should just make your own action plan to fix it. And there are many things that are designed in the wrong way, and you shouldn't think that other people know more than you. Your theory might be right, and you can become the new expert.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in over 20 strategic locations. They have extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com. As someone who's constantly on the road and traveling, Briggs & Riley has been a game changer that ensures my travel experience is phenomenal. I'm a satisfied customer of Briggs & Riley myself, and I can certainly tell you that their luggage performs. It's extremely durable, it has amazing features that make packing and getting around easier, and they have the best lifetime guarantee in the industry. If your bag is ever broken or damaged, they'll repair it free of charge, no questions asked, even if your airline damages the bag. They also just released their Simpatico collection of hard-sided luggage. It has this new one-touch feature which allows you to expand your luggage, pack it, then compress it to its original size so a carry-on can still fit in the overhead compartment, plus many other cool features. If you want luggage that was awarded the best carry-on by Forbes, then now's the time to get it. Get your new and improved luggage at Briggs-Riley.com. That's Briggs-Riley.com.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
All right, back to the show.
That's really, really beautiful. And I really love that we're talking so much about the education system, even though that seems like a lot of the most successful people, apparently, they just fail. I don't know if that's really motivating for students out there, but we have this saying in the education system that the good student knows the answer, but the brilliant student asks the questions. And uh-huh. I think that's really something to think about, because I mean, you can't get your A's if you are, you know, knowing all the right answers, but that's really not the whole point about being a student. And I think that's something a lot of students really, you know, they miss the target here, because they're thinking, I need to know the answer to the questions that my professor's asking. But instead, they should be saying, is it correct what he's saying? Can I challenge that? And I think a lot of people won't ask because they might be afraid of provoking people, but basically, you know, we need to be challenged, we need to be original. And it seems to me, after reading the fantastic book, Getting There, is that a lot of these people are very original. I mean, the reason why they got ahead is because they're doing something different. It's not because they're doing the same thing as everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, at least that was my takeaway from reading the interviews.
Every one of them are creators. That's the thing. They're not, they're all creating something very big. Like, you know, some might argue that Warren Buffett didn't create anything. He's just an investor. I would totally disagree with that. I mean, he's a person who is creating, he created Berkshire Hathaway. And for anyone who knows the history of Berkshire Hathaway, it was a textile business. It was on the verge of going bankrupt, and he came in and created it into what it is today. It's amazing what he's accomplished with it. But every one of these people created something very unique in whatever their field is. And that's why they've, you know, risen to the top.
And one thing, a lot of people in the book, you know, we were kind of bashing the education system, but everybody in this book would say that education is really important. And one of the things that Warren Buffett thinks is the most important skill a person can have is good communication skills, both in writing, you know, and in your speech. And, you know, there's a lot of ways to learn that, but certainly in my case, I learned a lot of that in school and in law school, you know.
Jillian, tell the people what you wrote in the book about what he has on the wall, what diploma he has on the wall, and in reference to what your comment you just made.
Okay, well, up until the age of 20, Warren Buffett was petrified of public speaking. And when I say that, I mean he would literally throw up at the thought of having to get up in front of a crowd and say anything. So he arranged his whole life so he would never be in this situation. If there was a class that in business school or something, he just wouldn't take it. If that was part of it. So he one day forced himself to sign up for the Dale Carnegie Public Speaking School. And he has the certificate from that $100 class on his wall. And he says that that this $100 certificate has had more of an impact on his subsequent success than any other degree he has. Because it really taught him communication skills. And what's really essential, no matter what business you're in, is getting other people to follow your ideas. So if you're a salesman, you want people to, you know, buy what you're telling them to buy. If you're a manager, you want them to follow your ideas in business. Whatever it is, you know, if you're making a book, you want to convince people to be in the book. You want to present it well. You want, you know, if you're looking for investors for your company, same thing. So anyway, he talks about the importance of this. And I think that that education, you know, in school can really help this. But so many other things can. I'll tell you one thing that is one of the most surprising things I learned in doing this book is how many of my subjects credit early jobs in sales for giving them the skills they needed for their ultimate success. And one of these skills is being a persuasive communicator.
That's Mark Cuban's biggest point in his book that he wrote. If you're a person who came out of sales, he immediately likes you because that's kind of where he got his start, was in sales. And he just can't stress the importance of that enough. I want to highlight, too, that Jillian talked about how Buffett had this Dale Carnegie certificate in his office. He does not have, from my understanding, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but he does not have his diploma from Columbia or anything else hanging on the wall. It's just that certificate and then a picture of his dad. Is that right?
Well, I think he probably has some other pictures and things, but he has no other degrees or anything. That's it. No business school, no college, nothing.
Hey, I want to ask this one, and this will be our last one, Jillian. Well, actually, Stig got one after this that he's going to ask that we ask everybody, and we want to ask, make sure we ask that. But the question that I got for you really relates to your interview with Anderson Cooper, because I found this interview with him really fascinating, and it really kind of... I had a preconceived notion about Anderson Cooper. I thought because he came out of the Vanderbilt family that he had all these connections and that's how he landed his position at CNN. And he was basically from the family and the background that had all the connections for him to get to where he's at. That was my preconceived notion. But then after I read this interview that you had in your book, I was floored at what I was reading and how he got his start and how, you know, it talks about, and I'm just going to give a quick thing here. So he definitely was not your typical case. Specifically, his brother's suicide and his father's death played a huge role in his achievement and how it basically flushed out any fear that he had in his life to be able to do some of the things that he did. Can you tell our audience a little bit about his story and some of those finer points?
Well, yes. So basically, his father died when he was 10. And when he was 21, his 23-year-old brother jumped off the terrace of his family's penthouse apartment as his mother pleaded for him to stay put. So he had a lot of tragedy in his life. And I think that he wanted to sort of be around other people who had gone through tragedies and survived. And he sort of wanted to see how they did it, which is why, you know, a lot of his career, he has been going to different war-torn countries and being around these people because he can really identify with them. But another thing about him that was really surprising is you would think that because of, you know, his family's wealth and connections, that he would have, you know, gotten an in on connections. But the truth is that he could not get an entry-level job at any of the major networks after he got out of college, and he went to Yale. So it wasn't even like, you know, he went to a top school and had a, you know, a wealthy family, but still he couldn't get an entry-level job. So he ended up hearing about an agency that produces youth-oriented programming for high schools called Channel One, and he got a job as a fact checker there. But really, he wanted to be a foreign news correspondent, and he quickly realized that when you do a job at a company, people there just tend to pigeonhole you in whatever role you're in. And if you want to do something different, you have to make that happen yourself. You have to either specifically, you know, ask, and if that doesn't work, you've got to do something drastic sometimes, he says, to change people's perception of you. So what he did is he quit his job. He went overseas, lived on $5 a day, sleeping in roach infested hotels and rooftops. And he shot his own stories and he made them as interesting and dangerous as possible, then offered them back to Channel One for such a low price that they couldn't refuse. And that is how he broke into the business.
And during this time, he wasn't on contract with this little high school news company. He just basically said, you know what? I'm not a fact checker. I am going to be on the show. And he just up and left, like basically quit his job completely, goes over there, is paying on his own dime to shoot this stuff with his own little handheld cam recorder. And then mm-hmm. he's sending these videos back and he's saying, hey, will you buy this from me?
Yes, that's exactly what he did. He just, it was, you know what? I think that no matter what field you're in, you have to be an entrepreneur. So like everyone has to be that. If you're an artist, you have to be an artist entrepreneur. You just, everyone is, you know, he's a journalist, but that doesn't mean he got in to some track and went along. He made his own path and made his own opportunities.
Yeah.
I think that's a really good point because, you know, as I read all these stories, as you're saying, they're all entrepreneurs. I mean, they're doing something original, something people haven't done before. I mean, I couldn't find a place in the book where you said, so I started as an assistant and then I became associate. And then, I mean,
yeah, that, you don't see that at all. You're right.
No, that's not the story of this successful people, right?
No, you've got to, like, you know, you have got to think your way to the top and claw your way to the top and sweat your way to the top.
Yeah. I really like the point with Anderson Cooper that you're saying is so many people get a job and they're told that they're a fact checker or they're told that they're a whatever. And if once they're told that, they kind of believe it. Maybe they still have aspirations. But the longer that they stay in that role, like if Anderson Cooper stayed in that role as a fact checker for 5 years, he might still be a fact checker today, but maybe working for a different company because he had it ingrained and beat into his head that that's what maybe some other person thought, that he was a fact checker. But if you stay in that role for too long, and you might actually start to believe that you are a fact checker, even though you might not be. And I think it's really important for people to stand up for what you think you are. And just because other people are telling you that you are a fact checker, you need to go out there and create your own destiny and push back and be mindful of the fact that the longer you stay in that role and what people are saying that you are, the more likely it is that you might become that.
Yeah. So. And you need to just decide on your own what it is that you want and just go for it and make your own opportunities.
That's right. All right, Stig, give her the final question that we give every one of our guests.
Yes, so one of the questions that we always like to ask the people that we interview is what the book they like the most. So aside from your own, of course, do you have any other books that have drastically shaped your life? If so, what are they and how have they impacted you?
Well, one book that I find myself thinking about a lot, and I read it years ago, it was called The Glass Castle. Have either of you read that?
I have not.
Okay. It's a great read. And it's by a woman named Jeanette Walls. And she grew up in such an impoverished and dysfunctional family. And she found success. So it's a memoir, but it's so inspirational, and it makes me feel like the best parent.
I'm sure you are, Jillian.
but I just think, like, you know, she went through that and she made, you know, she became a journalist.
So, Jillian, I'm gonna throw this out there, and I know that I'm probably going to embarrass you when I do this, but, and I'm not just saying this because you're on the show, but this book was truly inspirational, okay? Whenever I read this book and I was going through each one of these stories, that's really what I got out of this. This was a book of inspiration as you're reading this, because each one of these enormously successful people aren't talking about all the things that they necessarily did right to get to where they're at. They talked about their struggles and their hardships and how they are so human. And I think that that's a tribute to your writing and your writing style in the book, is everyone came across as so human and you can really empathize with them, even though they're these, you know, countless people and they're billionaires. You can really empathize with each one of these people. And it's an inspiration for me and for Stig and for anybody else that reads this to know that, hey, these people are just like me and I can achieve at this level if I stay persistent and if I create my own business, or I'm an entrepreneur, and if I push back against what other people are telling me that I might be or not be. And so I'll tell you, for our audience, this is a book that I am heavily promoting, and I'm doing that for a reason, is because after you read this, you're going to be just so much more enlightened as to what it is that you've got to do in your life in order to take it to the next level. Whatever your ambitions are, you're going to find it in this book. So the name of the book is Getting There. We'll have a link to the book in our show notes. So if you guys can't remember, if you're driving into work or whatever, just go to our show notes. We'll have a link there where you can go to Amazon and find it. Jillian, did you have any other places that you wanted to hand people off to?
A lot of people are curious about how these essays came to be. And basically, I would interview each subject and I would take the transcript, and it was probably about 20 pages each. And I edited it away to about 5 or 6 pages per person. And when I was done with that, I would send the essay back to the subject for his or her approval, because I wanted to make sure I didn't mess up anything in the editing process, and I wanted everyone to be completely comfortable with what they shared and how they came across. So, you know, each essay is just about 5 or 6 pages, which I like, because you could pick the book up, read one, put it down. It's not a big investment.
It's a great coffee table book too, because if somebody's sitting there, they can read the Warren Buffett story in not a real short amount of time, but it's just enough that you really get the essence of what he's talking about. And that's what I liked, was everything's very compact and you really get the essence of each of these people. That's what's great about it. But
yeah, and perhaps what is even better, or what I would thoroughly enjoy, was the pearls. So, like, really short paragraph at the end of each of the interview that Jillian is making. So they would just say, so what is your takeaway advice for the reader, Warren Buffett, right? So it was really compact, and that's really suitable for a coffee table.
It is. It really is. Problem with mine is if I put it out on our coffee table, A, my son would probably throw it all over the place because he's 2. But everyone else that would look at this, they would see that the whole thing is yellow because I have the whole thing highlighted with all the different quotes and things that were in here. So, Jillian, yeah, no, it was really good. So, Jillian, great to have you on the show. Thank you so much for being with us. And for our audience out there, we'll see you guys next week. We're going to skip over the question this week, but next week we'll have the question from our audience. And if you want to submit a question to our show that could potentially get played on a future show, go to asktheinvestors.com and you can record your question there. So I'd like to thank everybody for joining us, and we'll see you guys next week.
Thanks for listening to The Investors Podcast. To listen to more shows or access to the tools discussed on the show, be sure to visit www.theinvestorspodcast.com. Submit your questions or request a guest appearance to The Investors Podcast by going to www.asktheinvestors.com. If your question is answered during the show, you will receive a free autographed copy of the Warren Buffett Accounting Book. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. This material is copyrighted by the TIP Network and must have written approval before commercial application. TIP.